Up next, we have Paul and Guillaume, who are going to present on WASM engines. Take it away.
I'm going to do this one alone. I'm going to do WASM engines alone. Okay, hello. My name is Paul. I'm going to talk about WebAssembly engines for eWASM. Those are they. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The first three or four we have working at in some capacity. It seems that there's a big push to use the Firefox and the Chromium WebAssembly engines. They have various sort of tiers of engines. They have their baseline engines, which are just single pass, linear pass to compile to machine code. Then there are the optimized versions. I was asked to talk about WebAssembly engines, but I just want to talk about what WebAssembly is in general. So there's a 150-page specification, and it specifies a syntax of the language, so a grammar, so how to construct programs. And on top of this definition of the syntax, they define a validity, which says you're guaranteed to return or pass some arguments, and it's guaranteed to do certain things. And then finally, they define execution. Execution is defined as rewrite rules. What is that? Okay, so somewhere in some WebAssembly program, we have these two opcodes, const 0 and call 0. What does it mean? What does it do? Imagine 0, okay, so first of all, WebAssembly is given to you as a module. It's a WebAssembly module.wasm file. It's a set of functions. It's a memory. It's some abstraction that lets you do function pointers. That's called a table. Some things to initialize these tables and these memories. Things to import and export. And you have this module, which is a set of functions. So it maps well to an Ethereum account, which is also account code, which is also a set of functions. And you can call, you have imports and exports, so different modules can call between each other. But somewhere in one of the modules, in one of the functions, we see this. What is it? What does it mean? So const 0, 32-bit const, and call 0. Call 0 means call a function, the function in this module which has index 0. So imagine that's the function that has index 0. That's WebAssembly code. You don't have to know what it means, but it's some chunk of whatever that you can execute when you see this code somewhere else in that module. So this is how a WebAssembly program executes. We see these two opcodes, and then we execute these opcodes by rewriting wherever we see this, we replace it with that chunk. So what is this chunk? We take everything in this function, loop to get local, we copy it, we paste it here, we use something called the frame. This is just what it says in the spec. I'm just mechanically doing what they say in the spec to do. Then we have in these brackets, we say locals. There's a parameter, it takes that constant 0, we copy and paste it here. Then we wrap all of this code in something called a block. That's just what it says to do, so that's what I'm doing. I'm just rewriting that, I'm deleting it, and I'm replacing it with that. Then what happens? Then we rewrite the thing that says block with this. I just read the specification, I'm just doing what it told me to do. Then what? I rewrite where it says loop, and I put in label 0, and then I copy and paste all of this text, including the loop part, into here. I wrote it in small text so it could fit. What happens next? This get local. So we're sort of going along. We saw a block, we saw a loop, then we see a get local opcode. What does that mean? What does it do? It says to take that const 0, that's the first local, there could be more, and copy and paste it, delete where it says get local, and paste into it where it was i32 const 0. Then what? So we're sort of going along, and then we see these three opcodes. What do we do with these three opcodes? It's a rewrite rule again. We replace these three opcodes with the sum of the two, so we replace it with a const 1. As you see, it's just rewrite rules. The whole semantics, the whole execution semantics is we're just rewriting chunks, we're copying and pasting text. What's next? We have a tlocal, which means we take whatever's above it, put it into the local const, and then we also paste it here, and we delete where it says tlocal. I'm just rewriting stuff. I'm not doing anything controversial. It's just what the spec told me to do. Then I'm doing a less than unsigned operation and replacing it with a 1 because 1 is, in fact, less than 3. So anyway, this just keeps going and going, and finally I get to this. And this is my last slide for the WASM engines talk. So what's the point? Why did I just waste your time with this sort of rewrite rule stuff? I went from this somewhere in my code, and I just rewrote it a bunch of times all the way down to this. And that's how we executed WebAssembly. These rewrite rules, so what's the point? That's how the spec defines it. It's just rewrite rules. Nobody implements their engine like this. People implement their engines with stacks. There could be 1 stack, there could be 2 stacks, there could be 3 stacks. When I implemented the engine, I did it with 3 stacks for various reasons. There's stacks for these function call frames. I have a stack for the function call frames, I have a stack for the labels, and I have a stack for the operands. Other people keep their function call frames and their control flow labels in the same stack. There's advantages to doing it my way because if you keep these in the same stack, you have to sort of, every time you return from a function, you have a linear time if you're nested in a bunch of functions. So that could be a slowdown. The point is, everyone implements their engines however they want to implement it. And people do it differently, but the whole goal is to make web apps. They want to have, like, you know, alien fighting games in their browsers and things like that. And if that crashes, if that fails, who cares? But if everyone's implementing things their own way, then maybe someone's going to have a bug, someone's going to introduce an invariant that they're going to ignore later on, and something's going to go wrong. And if it's a web app, who cares? But if it's a dApp, when there's a lot of money on the line, then we might have problems. So I think we have to focus and spend a lot of time making sure we implement it right to audit these engines. We talk about Firefox and Chromium. They want to have some micro-optimizations for their benchmarks that they're interested in. Do we want these micro-optimizations? So I'm just asking questions about, do we trust this stuff? The spec says to rewrite stuff. No one's rewriting it. Everyone's just doing it their own way. So what's the right way to do it? I think we have to audit and keep a close eye on everything. So that's the WebAssembly engines talk. Is that okay? So, Islaine, I'm giving the next talk as well. It's called Turbo eWASM, Increasing Transaction Throughput. Turbo eWASM is our code word within our team of increasing transaction throughput. This is joint work between Guillaume and I, and other people on the team, of course, have had good conversations with us. And so the big idea is, what are we doing now? Ethereum execution. It's serial execution, as you all know. We're disk I/O bound, they say, and we have max 20 transactions per second. What does it mean? What does serial execution mean? We're executing transaction 1, then we're executing transaction 2, then we're executing transaction 3, and so on until the last transaction. What does disk I/O bound mean? This isn't to scale, by the way, but if you took some operating systems course, you've seen some image where you're doing some work, and then you're waiting for I/O, and you're waiting, and you're waiting. And if it's disk I/O bound, the disk, these sort of I/O ranges dominate the work ranges. And so we're waiting, and waiting, and waiting for disk I/O to come back. And it comes back, and we do work, and we do work, and we do work, and now we're waiting, and waiting again. And so we're doing 20 transactions per second, and I don't know, when sort of engineers see this kind of thing, they're bothered. Why can't we improve this, because this is awkward and we're engineers and we know how to do these kinds of things. So that's, Guillaume and I had some conversations about this. So Ethereum shards, we might have the same thing. Shard 1 might also be limited to 20 transactions, likewise with shard 2, likewise with all of the shards. So some use cases like these Plasma on-ramps, off-ramps, state channels, payment channels, whatever, might not be usable if we only have 20 transactions per second. So sharding does help us scale in some sense, but is it meaningful? We still can't use, if a million people want to get out of this payment channel, it's still unusable. So let's try to talk about increasing throughput on each individual shard and maybe cross shards. So when people say, why can we use sharding, they start talking about independent universes, independent galaxies. Things are independent. What does it mean? What does independence mean? So I guess two transactions, so we'll define what independence means. Two transactions are independent if they do not touch the same state location. This is an illustration, transaction one and transaction two. Transaction one touches the upper left, the transaction two touches the two bottoms. And you can consider these transactions independent of each other. In different shards, we're guaranteed, they say, that a transaction in shard one and a transaction in shard two are independent of each other. So we can, that's the whole idea. They're independent galaxies, we can execute them concurrently. But how about transactions within the same shard? So the focus of this talk is within shard transactions and cross shard transactions. A cross shard transaction is a transaction, for example, from shard one to shard two. Okay, so what does someone that wants to scale do? An engineer usually will go to perhaps Wikipedia and look up models of concurrency, and they'll read about actors models and process calculus models, and maybe we can use these things. And people are looking at this. I spoke with the actors with capabilities, the gentleman that invented the Primea, which Definity is using, then Agoric is using these ideas, process calculi, R-chain, Rolang, doing great work, fantastic work, and they're talking about parallelizing and increasing transaction throughputs. They're also using this idea of independence. With Primea, they're called VATs, or with the actors and capabilities in general, they're called VATs. A shard is equivalent to a VAT in some sense. And for process calculi, they call it namespaces. So everyone's using independence. So, you know, a good scientist or engineer says, what is this independence thing? Let's define what this means, and let's take it as far as we can take it, because, you know, we're engineers, we're working at the margins, let's see what we can do. Okay, so we're going to define what an independent subset of a block is. An independent subset of a block of transactions is such that each transaction is a subset, such that each transaction in the subset is independent of all transactions outside of that subset. That's a tough definition, that's the toughest definition of this talk. For example, an independent subset is transactions 2 and 3. They're independent of all transactions outside of the subset. Transaction 2 is independent of 1. Transaction 3 is independent of 1. So these two are an independent subset.
Just to clarify, that's because transaction 1 do not write to any location that the set of TX2 and transaction 2 and transaction 3 write to.
Correct.
Yeah.
So we have some sort of, maybe you can have a visual proof that you see that transaction 1 writes to this, and it's independent. Based on this, the definition of independence, which was in a previous slide, which is a relationship between two transactions. And an independence partition of a block of transactions is its partition into independent subsets. Partition, we know disk partitions. Partition of a set is breaking it into subsets such that their union is the whole set and their pairwise intersection is empty. So the independence partition of this sort of block would be one subset is this, just this transaction, a subset with this transaction, and the other subset is these two transactions. And we notice that we might be able to run these concurrently because they're independent of each other, just like shards are independent of each other. Okay, so how do we build this independence partition? For two or three transactions, we can just look and point and say, look, these are independent, but if we have a whole block of things, it might be difficult. So we have some algorithms to partition the pool. A transaction pool or block of transactions into independent subsets. What is access lists, first of all? There's EIP 648. There's a push with each transaction. You say, I'm going to touch these state locations and only these state locations. If I violate this, then my transaction is invalid. So there's a push for access lists in shards. So there's two cases. We can do it with access lists or without access lists. Let's talk first about with access lists. So I'm going to do a visualization, and it might be tough. So we have our block. We order our transactions from 1, just forget about anything below transaction 0, transaction 1, all the way to transaction 63. We notice that and then we write the same transactions on this column. We notice that transaction 0 and transaction 0 interact with are dependent on each other. So we put a orange square there, and also 63. Whatever this is based on accesses. We take these access lists, we compare, see if they intersect with the transaction 0 and 63. Yes, they do for 0 and 63. So we put a orange square there, and we can partition this block of transactions. Into independent subsets. So this subset, this subset, this chunk of transactions is independent of all other transactions. Why? Because there's no orange, things colored in here. So this is maybe the kitty cat app. This is a decentralized exchange. This is some mixer. This is some ICO. These are one-off transactions, and we can execute each of these sort of chunks independently of each other. Because of this independence property, just like shards are independent. Jim?
Yeah, I'm just saying, do you want me to do that so that you don't have to walk all the time?
I got it.
Okay.
Likewise, if you have many more transactions, you can break it into independent subsets. So this is just an idea to parallelize a given block. We're not doing it yet. So that's the big... So you see these independent, there's many, so we can do it, we can scale this. Okay, without access lists, it's awkward. We currently don't have access lists in Ethereum, so we might execute a transaction, see if it sort of hinders our concurrency. So if it touches a bunch of these independent subsets, then we won't include it. Of course, there's a DOS attack. Worst case, we'll go to serial execution. But this is one possibility to scale the main chain. And it's all based on independence. The simple idea that, independent universes, galaxies, we're just taking this as far as we possibly can, like we're maybe scientists or engineers. So then each independent subset we execute on its own CPU, perhaps. We've already known this since EIP 648. This is nothing new. But this looks like the sharding picture, where shard 0, shard 1 to shard n, but each one is sort of not shard. We're sort of dynamically creating shards. And we're solving two important problems. Within a single shard and cross shards, we can use these ideas. So we, Guillaume and I, are sort of trained in computer science, and we sort of talk about operating systems. And when you take an operating systems course, you learn about threads and preemption. And we have this disk I/O bottleneck. So our idea is to use threads. So each thread corresponds with an independent subset. So we start executing thread one, which is independent, the top left corner of independent. Or whatever, it starts executing, it asks for disk I/O. There's a scheduler in operating systems, as you know. It'll preempt this thread while it's waiting for I/O and schedule this thread. So it's doing work. This thread starts waiting, this independent subset is waiting for I/O, preempted. This one's doing work. So we're essentially trying to use 100% CPU. So we're trying to eliminate this I/O bottleneck, whether it's disk I/O, whether it's network I/O, whatever it may be. And we're just using things from operating system. We can just use a regular operating system with pthreads or whatever. This stuff is available now. Or do it, with many CPUs. So hopefully we can use 100% of hardware. That's the dream of, computer scientists, use 100% of hardware, I think. So Guillaume, can you clean up?
Quick, maybe a reminder. So the question, thank you, was about bottleneck. So I/O, Paul has very, very well explained that I/O is a bottleneck. In Ethereum 1.0, it's disk I/O. It's apparently it's debated whether it's the biggest bottleneck, but it's definitely up there. In Ethereum 2.0, if you start having stateless clients, if you need to get your state from the network, it's not so much disk I/O. Well, ultimately, it will be disk I/O, but it's not so much disk I/O as network latency and things like that. But that means that you will spend a lot of time waiting for your data to arrive or to be written. And as a result, this really makes sense to try to get the computer or the miner to do something while this is happening. So what we want to do with this work, like that was the preliminary research work. What we want to do is to increase, to extend the definition of independence between transactions. Do you want, for example, imagine you have let's say an ICO or a CryptoKitty kind of profile where a lot of transactions correspond to the same contract. Can you also generalize the independence to calls within the same contract? Can you, for example, use something like SIMD or some MapReduce programming paradigm so that you can make sure that every single thread or every single transaction touches a different area of the state and run them concurrently, knowing that they won't interfere. That's what we're looking into. We also want to look into other ideas. For example, gas calculation. So you heard before about the metering or the Sentinel contract, something that will scan your contract and add calls to use gas to make sure that the gas get properly accounted for. What we would like to do maybe is we would like to see if we can explore. We would like to explore possibilities to actually pre-meter the contracts, reduce the need to do this, because first you have to scan the contract, but then every time you have to make a call, and that's kind of inefficient. So we want to see if we can just have simple gas rules, see if we can have an upper bound or a formula. We just look at your binary, and we say, okay, this is roughly what it's going to cost, and charge that. One of the interesting things that really, where WASM really brings a benefit, it's the replace contracts call with function calls. So right now when you call a contract, you have to reinstantiate a lot of things. Like you basically, I'm talking about Geth, you create pretty much a new VM, a lot of data structures. But ultimately, this is what you want to do is a function call. You're not actually calling a contract on a different computer. You're calling something on the same computer. So why not make it a function call? So you would have something like import, in pseudocode or pseudo Python, import that function from a contract address and just get everything loaded. And you can start doing lots of things. Get inspired by operating systems, manage modules, like operating systems manage libraries. If you see that a module gets loaded very often, you just leave it in memory so that when you load it, it's already there. You can do something, require modules to have the full list of contracts, to basically like you had access lists for state locations, you could also enforce the same thing for modules. We also get inspired by TurboGeth. Unfortunately, the TurboGeth presentation was at a concurrent time in a different room. The try to replace all the state try, or at least try to optimize the way it's stored, the way it's accessed. Maybe that's still a suggestion from the name escapes me.
Alexei,
thank you.
Smart guy.
Very smart guy. How to maybe have all those contracts, all those states in a linear contiguous space, why not, with protection, of course. We also want to use some of the features of WASM that are on the roadmap. They haven't been released yet, or at least not officially agreed on yet, but you have mutexes, you have SIMD. So for those who don't know, SIMD is a single instruction multiple data. So the processor has one instruction that does the same thing several times. It uses the parallelism that is inside the processor. And yeah, that's what we're looking into.
Yep.
And I think that was it. Doesn't work.
Yep, that's the last one.
Okay, that's the last one, that's why.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Guillaume and Paul. That was really intense. Big applause again for them. One addition to all of this is we are considering all these different improvements. And we're in a really lucky position that we can consider adding these improvements to the eWASM testnet or spinning up a new eWASM testnet and add these improvements to it. But hopefully, if we manage to add any of these, they're going to be a really good testbed to have them fully specified and finally implemented in the mainnet. Now, next one on stage is Casey DiTrio. Casey has been around forever. He's really into research, and he's more into keeping Ethereum alive and into improve Ethereum. And his talk will be about a new idea how you could do scaling on a much bigger scale. And we may also consider having this on eWASM at some point. Big applause for Casey.
Thank you. Yeah, it's not exactly a new idea. It's just Ethereum 2.0, the Jasper Serenity research, which I heard in the news recently that the Ethereum 2.0 research is finally stabilizing, which is good to hear, because maybe now we can answer one of the most basic questions, which is how are we going to deal with a large and growing account state? This is one of the main problems in scaling. Even if we wanted to scale 1.0, we would have to deal with the account state. Sorry, and this actually doesn't have really anything to do with eWASM, because eWASM is just an execution engine, and the execution reads and writes to the state. So if you want to implement an execution engine, then you got to decide how you're going to handle the state. So I guess it kind of falls on us to decide that. So we wanted to say a little bit about it. This talk, it's not going to be highly technical. This is supposed to be an overview of like the developer experience and the user experience and the challenges and changes that will have to be made in order to scale Ethereum. So just the goal is having a lot of users, a lot of transactions, and transactions and where the gas price remains cheap. If the gas supply is limited and you have a lot of users, then the gas price goes sky high. So how do we get gas prices cheap again? Well, if you don't want to sacrifice decentralization, you could just run all the validator nodes on, all transactions on 21 validator nodes on supercomputers. But if you don't want to trade off decentralization, then ideally you'd be able to run a validator node on, you know, any consumer laptop. That way you can just keep adding more laptops and the network can scale. So to solve this dilemma, our hero, sharding, Jasper McShardface. What's the plan? Phase one, we collect a lot of data blobs. We have a pretty comprehensive spec for doing this. It's like 8 different teams building it out. It's the Beacon Chain. They say, you know, some of these prototypes should be functional soonish. And then there's phase two. Well, phase two, we think we're going to use eWASM, but we're not really sure how we're going to do phase two. We still have to iron out some details. Oops. But there is good news, because phase one is actually the hard part. So phase one is the consensus protocol. The consensus protocol comes to consensus on the order of the data blobs. The consensus protocol is actually very complicated, because the outcome is non-deterministic. Every validator has a different view of the network. You know, data blobs arrive in different orders to different validators. You have all kinds of hairy game theory issues with malicious actors and network partitions, and it's a challenge. Phase two, relatively speaking, is much more straightforward. All you have is it's a deterministic system. The order of the data blob is already known. You have one block, you process it. You get, the next block comes, you process it, and so forth. So if phase one is behind us and you only have to worry about the execution engine in phase two next, then you're actually, not that far from the finish line. But we learned yesterday that Jasper is actually kind of lame. He can be a bit of a buzzkill. My two main complaints about Jasper are that, for one, it won't shard. It won't scale contracts that exist on the main chain. Jasper is going to be, Serenity will be a new, parallel universe of 1,000 empty shards, and users will have to migrate to them, redeploy contracts, transfer state somehow. But when it launches, it'll be a ghost town. Get it, Casper, ghost town. Secondly, shards are going to have, the gas prices will be independent on each different shard. So, in theory, this is not really a problem, because if you end up on a really popular shard and the gas price is expensive, then you can just, move to a cheaper shard where there's not as much activity. Yes, in theory, it's kind of like telling people, who live in San Francisco and are complaining that the city is not scaling the supply of housing, that, well, it's no problem, you should, because you can just move to North Dakota. 1.0 problem, the scaling problem in general, 1.0, 2.0, is that there's too much state. Users pay a one-time gas fee, they create an account in the state tree, and that account is there forever, and all the full nodes, all the miners, just have to keep all this, junk around indefinitely. So what techniques do we have, what approaches do we have to reduce the state? We have two of them, stateless clients and storage rent. With stateless clients, there's a single 32-byte storage route. And when you send a transaction to the network, so miners, validators, have only the 32-byte storage route. And when you, as a user, send a transaction to the network, you have to supply the Merkle proof of your account, so you can prove that your account has such and such a balance, and you can send Ether. These Merkle proofs have to be up to date. So I'm have a visualization of that next. But in contrast, storage rent, validators, basically, users pay validators to do this job, to keep the account in their state and to keep the Merkle proofs up to date. And when you have storage rent with an eviction or a sleep and awake, like a if accounts don't pay rent, then they get evicted from the tree. But then there's ways that they can be revive their account and come back into the tree. Then, basically those techniques are very similar to how stateless clients work. So it's kind of like with storage rent, there's two classes of users. There's like first class people who can afford the rent, who the validators handles all of their Merkle proofs, and the second class, which is all the poor people who have been evicted and will have to supply their Merkle proofs in order to reawaken their accounts. With stateless clients, there's just the one class. It's everybody, in Coach, everybody has to supply their Merkle proofs. Yeah, it's not a new idea either. This is from the Ethereum analysis report from Least Authority back in 2015, and it was even discussed in Bitcoin before then. The problem with keeping your Merkle proofs up to date is that at the top is the state root, and then, so at the top of the tree, at the bottom are the leaves. These are where the accounts are. So your account is one leaf, and then next to you is another account, and that's somebody else's account. But the branch, the proof data that you want to supply is this Merkle branch from, your leaf account up to the state root. And in that branch are these intermediate tree nodes. Now, these intermediate tree nodes change when the guy next to you makes a transaction. So it's not, so if you go offline and then you come back, it doesn't matter that you didn't make any transactions. It matters that, other people are making transactions, and now your proof is out of date. So you have to go back in history and kind of reprocess these transactions to get your proofs up to date. So people really don't like either statelessness or storage rent. The reason they don't like statelessness is because, again, the problem of keeping your Merkle proofs up to date. Also, somebody who flirts and smokes weed a lot said this, that when I wake up from cryosleep, I just want my brain wallet to work. I don't want to have to, you imagine if 50 years later, your proof would have just been changed, within the first year after you went to sleep. So if those blocks are still available somewhere, then you're okay. But the question is, what happens if those blocks are no longer available? Then, you're screwed. And that's kind of why people also, you could say set up, there could be some service that says, I promise I will store, all the old blocks, even if you come back 50 years. Trust me, they'll be here. And people say, well, I don't want to trust these rickety, layer two services. I want, to have some guarantee that validators will be storing my my account. Obviously, people dislike rent because you get evicted if you don't pay. Also, capacity is limited, so the, fees can spike high. It breaks user experience that we've, come to expect, that a contract will still be there. There are workarounds for this, like if, again, this sleep and awake, but that's just, it adds complexity, which maybe you can tuck under the hood. From the implementer's point of view, if you're starting from scratch, then, in my opinion, stateless is obviously the way to go. It's clean, simple. It's ideal. Validator only has to store a 32-byte state root. Rent is messy and complex. There are lots of parameters. You have to decide, do you set it at 16 gigs or 32 gigs? And then, how do you do the fee market, so forth? I think some people, even the stateless is almost too simple, so they just like, engineers who sometimes like complexity, and they just can't resist from adding a rent feature onto the stateless. If you're not starting from scratch, so if you have like Ethereum 1.0 today, then it's probably easier. You already have a full tree that the miner is forced to store. It's probably easier to, add on a rent feature and, start trimming the accounts. Then, swapping out the whole thing and switching to statelessness. So lastly, the point is that change is coming here. currently miners have this full burden. And while it's, you know, it seems kind of easy because, you know, somebody else is, I don't know if you're using Infura or MetaMask or a Lite client, it's relatively easy to sync. If you're running a full node, it's still difficult to sync. What is going to happen is that it's not sustainable for miners to keep storing all the state. So validators are, the disk space is going to be minimized. The core of the network, you'll be able to sync very quick. So life for a validator will become great. The process of syncing and processing blocks will become very streamlined. But on the other hand, if you are a user or a wallet client, life is going to get somewhat painful. Syncing is going to be harder. Scraping, the data to, you have to manage your own data. You have to come up with your own proofs unless you, can pay the rent. So that's it. I mean, wallet developers, kind of a tough time ahead of you. That slide, okay. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Casey.
Big applause for Casey again. So thank you all for being here today. We're going to pull up the URLs again. Please join the Gator Room. Try the testnet. The URL for that is ewasm.ethereum.org. All the demo what Jared has shown should be visible there. Join Gator again. Get the discussion started. We're going to have this EVM panel now, focused on EVM. We're probably going to be free after that if you guys have any more questions. That's all the details you need to know. Thank you.